Hello, I'm Dr. Dana Day.
And I'm Court Stumpf.
And I am Dr. Susan Schmidt. And welcome to the ABHA Listen and Learn podcast, hosted by Arizona Balance and Hearing. This is where we discuss all the latest advances in testing and treatment of all hearing and balance issues. And please don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any of our future episodes.
Welcome, everyone.
Hey, guys.
Hello.
Good to be here.
Good to see all of you.
Yeah. Episode 3.
Wow.
Episode 3.
Yeah.
Getting the hang of this.
Yes.
Kind of, yeah.
3 is usually the good one.
Oh, okay.
If you Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
Oh. Return of the King.
No pressure.
The Last Crusade. Yeah. So no pressure, guys. Mm-hmm. But that's our standard.
Okay. Uh-huh.
We have
right.
to live up to that.
Right. There. Absolutely. So, Susan, how's the study going?
That's exactly what I was going to ask.
It is going well. We still have a little bit more leeway to take a few more patients in and put you in one of our groups and see what we can do to help your tinnitus over time or in a short period of time, just depending on what group you're in.
Wonderful. Great.
And if listeners are interested, how do we get a hold of you to get into that study?
You can call our office, Arizona Balance and Hearing, at 602-265-9000.
And isn't there a special voicemail that they need to be directed to?
Yes, you will be directed. You just say, I'm interested in the tinnitus study, and you will be directed to a voicemail, which you will leave your information, and one of our residents will get back to you within a day or two, and we'll get you all signed up and participating in this current research study.
And how much does it cost?
It is free.
I'm just lobbing the softballs.
Yes. Free. Yeah,
free. Free, free, free. Yes. Like I said, we're just looking at different types of intervention as far as your tinnitus. So we would just love your participation to come in. If you are truly bothered by your tinnitus and you have it on a constant level, we would love for you to come in and try one of these treatments and see what happens.
Cool.
Great.
So I know I'm jumping the gun a little bit because I know we're probably going to discuss this in a future episode, but I wanted to share with you guys, I watched The Sound of Metal.
I did too.
You did?
Mm-hmm.
Did you watch it,
me
Susan?
Me too.
Okay.
It makes me tense just thinking about it.
So for those of you who are not familiar, it's an Amazon original feature film. Fantastic. It's up for, I want to say 6, I'm not sure, but it's up for a number of Academy Awards this year. And it's about a metal drummer in a duo band, and he very rapidly loses his hearing. And I saw it, and it doesn't take a lot to make me cry, so it happened anyways, but it was very good. So I'm glad you guys watched it too, and I know we're going to discuss that later on. But
yeah,
for those who have not seen it, go watch it.
Yes.
The Sound of Metal.
It's very intense.
It's very intense. And please, when you're watching it, keep in mind that it's a movie. There are some things that are very factual and there's some things that are not so factual. So, yes. And when we meet together to discuss it, we can talk in more.
Good.
Yeah.
That's a teaser for episode
4. That's a teaser, yeah.
4.
It's a great movie. It is a great movie.
Watch it, people, so you can hang with us on episode 4 when we talk about The Sound of Metal.
Yes. Good. But for today's episode, we're excited to speak with Dr. Jill Davis. She's an audiologist in Austin, Texas, that is doing some alternative therapies with her patients to improve cognition and the use of their hearing technology, especially hearing in noise. So I am so excited to talk with Jill today.
And she's focusing on music treatments too as well, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So we're going to jump in on that.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yes. Yeah, super excited to hear her research on both music and how that relates to hearing and cognition, and very interested. and what she's finding out so far.
So we're so happy to introduce our guest today, Dr. Jill Davis. Dr. Davis received her doctorate from the University of Cincinnati and has been practicing audiology for 14 years. She was lucky enough to spend her fourth-year externship at ABHA and then moved to Austin, Texas after graduating. She is the owner of Victory Hearing and Balance and specializes in hearing testing, protection, and rehabilitation, as well as tinnitus, dizziness, auditory processing disorders, cochlear implants, and auditory training. She is a mentor to other audiologists for implementing cognitive screening in their practice and created the Victory Brain Training Program to help her patients hear better. Welcome, Jill, and it's so good to see you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's so great to see you.
It's great to see you, too. Now, this is a case, Susan, where the student now becomes the teacher.
Yes.
Because both of us got the privilege of working with you, Jill, and you were one of our first fourth-year extern students. Do you remember that?
Was I really?
Yes.
Yeah, well, back in 2006, right?
Yeah.
2005 or six.
Yeah. So,
what is an extern, by the way? I'm very familiar, unfortunately, with intern, having been one many times. But what is an extern?
Well, Jill, do you
Doctors.
Want to?
Yeah, well, so for our fourth year of our graduate degree, we still pay tuition, but we go and practice as audiologists with supervisors, and some are paid, some are not paid, but we spend our days learning to be an audiologist almost on our own, but it's that last year of our graduate degree where, physicians, what do they call it?
Like residency.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So we call them residents now.
Right. Yes.
Because it was too hard to explain what an intern or an extern is. And I could never figure out, are they interns or are they externs? Because they're in the office, but they're not from the office. So.
Right. So that's why I think they're externs. They're ex.
Okay.
Ex part of their school, and they're into something else. So
indentured servant is really what it is. Okay.
Pretty much.
I didn't know if that meant something different, but it sounds like a residency. So
yes.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah.
No, I really lucked out. It was the best placement ever. I learned so much from you guys.
Oh, thank you so much. And we so enjoyed having you with us as well. I did not realize you had left Phoenix and went right to Austin.
I stuck around for a little while. I got a job and then met a Texan who wanted to move back to Texas.
Oh,
so,
okay.
It took me away. But I did stick around after I graduated for a year.
Well, it has been so fun reconnecting with you. Just to let Susan know, Jill and I reconnected on a listserv site for auditory processing disorder. Mm-hmm. And then I've since learned of all the other stuff she's doing. So this has been really a fun reconnection.
Right.
And to know that our resident is surpassing us. So we must have done something right. I don't know what it would be, but it must have been something.
I wouldn't say that.
It's just a classic Skywalker situation, really.
Yes, there you go. So why don't we go ahead and get started, because I know your time is valuable. Jill, you and I were speaking a few months ago, and I found out that you, too, are a big admirer of Dr. Nina Kraus, a researcher at Northwestern, and her work with audition and how some disorders like concussion or dyslexia can have an effect on how the brain perceives speech. I am a huge fan of Dr. Kraus and have been for years. What can we see from her work in what you're doing today?
She's just my hero. I mean, I love everything coming out of that Brain Volts lab. It just means so much to what we're doing. And I stumbled across her work when I was looking at the connection between music and audiology. I had been reading a book called This Is Your Brain on Music by Daniel Levitin. And I also saw a presentation on the correlation between hearing loss and cognitive change. And at the time I was like, what is the connection between music and audiology that we don't see and we don't know about? Because if untreated hearing loss can cause the brain to change to compensate, and music can stimulate every part of the brain, there has to be a connection that we can use with our patients to stop cognitive decline and to help them hear better. So I started years of reading and finding that neuromusical research. And at Nina Krause's lab, she's doing all of these tests with musicians and non-musicians and comparing their performance in speech-related activity and difficult listening environments. And she's finding that everyone with some musical training, they outperform the folks without. And I want those benefits for my patients. And so I was like, how can I have my patients act like these musicians? So she inspired me to create the brain training program that I have.
I've read that book, by the way, that you mentioned, This Is Your Brain on Music. I read it in high school and it was fantastic. At that time, I didn't understand a lick of it, though. and it went right over my head. So I need to reread it again. But it's really cool hearing you reference that book and talk a little bit more about the connection between music and the brain. So yeah. Kudos to you on that. Yeah, but if anybody has not read that book, This Is Your Brain on Music, highly recommend it.
Yeah. You know, as I'm reading it, I'm saying this is grad school all over again. I mean, he does start and talk about the sound and what happens in the brain. And I'm like, okay, I've already learned all of this through grad school. So again, why don't we talk about music in audiology? And
exactly.
So that's what made me start looking at that.
And just to let you know, Court is a musician.
Oh, yeah, I should have maybe told you that.
I heard that on the last podcast.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
That's right.
Going on. Yes. He was an irresponsible musician.
Yes, I heard. There you go.
That's exactly just what a musician is. Like, if you just say musician, it kind of comes with the territory, I think.
Okay. So what were you seeing in your patients that you felt like you had to add another type of treatment to help them?
It's that difficulty hearing and background noise. How many times do we hear that from our patients or folks coming in to get hearing tested and they struggle to hear in challenging environments? And we get it with hearing loss, without hearing loss, with hearing aids and without hearing aids. It just seems to struggle for patients. And we know that to supplement the device, auditory training is helpful. There's a lot of research that shows training the brain to help them hear better in those environments can improve their performance. However, my practice had a pretty low adoption rate on those programs. I love LACE and CLEAR. You know, they're great, but some patients may get started and not follow through, or others just wouldn't even get started. And, you know, it was kind of frustrating for me when I know that they would benefit, but they wouldn't do it. So I wanted to find an alternative and something else. And so I turned to music, which I'm finding is pleasant and positive connection to it, and they're more motivated, and it seems like a fun hobby, and so the adoption rate is a bit higher.
I find that in just some of the stuff that I do with auditory processing disorders, I can get them to either the child or the adult to sit down with music more so than I can with a designated program they have to do over and over and over again. So that's really interesting. And then you, Susan, use music a lot with your tinnitus patients.
Yes, I do. And I do find that if the recommendation is to listen to music or do a certain activity with music, they are more willing to do that than other recommendations than I provide. It seems, you know, as long as it's easy and it's accessible and they engage in it, it seems like there is a better stick to keep going rather than just, oh, I'm supposed to do this program and then, you know, you just never hear from them again
kind of thing. Like better incentive for sure.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, and the research shows that music activates the reward center in the brain. It's rewarding to listen, but also to play. Mm-hmm. You get that little feedback loop and that reward center is activated. And so that's why it's more engaging and they tend to follow through.
Without getting too crazy medical, can you go into that, what that is exactly, the reward center? Because that sounds like you rack up points, and then after a while, you get a certain percentage off of merchandise.
It's like pinball, really.
Well, there's bad ways to activate the reward center, and those are kind of the addicts and such. There's ways that you can get that kind of instant gratification, but then the good ways are going to be like children learning in school, like after they've completed a level or they've learned a new skill, there's kind of that, aha, I got it, you know, and so there's great ways to activate that center. I don't know exactly what center or where, what the name, but that kind of, yes, I did it. That's what keeps coming and coming as you're learning new skills, playing music, those kinds of things.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So tell us about this therapy that you have created to help your patients.
Yeah, so we want to be aware of the word therapy versus training. So music therapy is administered by music therapists, just like speech therapists, occupational therapists, physical therapists. There is a board certification for music therapy, and they are going into nursing homes. They are working with neurological disorders. They are coming up with plans to help people talk again. This is not that therapy. This is music training, which is the act of playing an instrument. So audiologists cannot give music therapy. However, we can recommend music training. Okay. So that's what the program is. And I spent a lot of time looking for the right protocol, because knowing that playing an instrument improves your brain, well, how do you tell a patient, just go join a choir or play an instrument? You know, I wanted a set protocol. And so those neuromusical research studies will show different ranges from the instruments they use, the length of time that they're training. And so I kind of created an average of what I was finding and the shortest amount of time that I thought our patients could go through the program. I looked at the studies that found improvements in speech and noise, better understanding, better memory, executive function, and I found that 30 minutes a day, 3 days a week, for 3 months was enough for us to see improvements with playing the piano, which is how I created the program.
Wonderful.
And this musical training that you recommend, does this benefit everyone or just those with hearing loss?
Yeah, it's everyone. You know, our populations usually are coming in with the hearing loss, but you don't even need to have hearing loss to see the benefit, because they, you know, those neuroscientists, when they're measuring the brain, they take pictures and they see that with music training, the size of the brain improves. So the corpus callosum, that bridge between the two hemispheres, it's actually 3 times larger in someone who plays an instrument more than 3 days a week. And that's huge, because when you can build a connection between the hemispheres, things are easier, you learn faster, you process quicker. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of benefits that come from just building up that connection. But also, you know, you can reduce anxiety and depression. They found that music is more beneficial than anti-anxiety medication before surgical procedures. And so there's just so many benefits beyond just being able to hear speech better. And so everyone can, you know, kids are actually a grade ahead of their peers if they play music during school.
This may be an off question, but how has this information not, or maybe it has been, shared with, and maybe you don't know the answer, I'm kind of backpedaling here, but like, how is this information not more widely known, especially within school districts and things, and showing that there is more validity educationally to learning an instrument? Like, it seems like this data is so impressive that more people should know about it. And is that maybe because the research is still just kind of in its early stages, or are we just not doing a good job to get out the word? Yeah. Did that question make sense?
I'm on a mission to get the word out. No, you're right on track. I am on a mission. There is a group, it's biggerbetterbrains.com. It's Dr. Anita Collins, and she music educators to train the parents of students on this importance of music. And so she is on the same mission, trying to get kind of how physical education is mandatory in schools, trying to make music mandatory because it is so important. And so she's also trying to educate the music teachers to spread the word I'm trying to educate the audiologists to spread the word and just to get it out there, because yes, everyone could benefit. But the research is relatively new. It just started in the 90s when the functional MRI studies became available, the PET scans and the EEG caps. So that's when they really started seeing those changes in the brain and learning that we can find out more about the brain using music. And so just in the past 10 years, really, in 2010 is when they started doing really great control randomized longitudinal studies, where before they were just kind of putting adults in, putting kids in, and there wasn't a lot of structure to the studies. But just in the past 10 years, that's when Nina Krause's lab has really like stepped up and made it more legit. Is that the word?
Yeah. So you're on a mission. That's really admirable.
Yes. Well, and I don't want to get political because this isn't a political show, but I can only speak with Arizona, and a lot of it is out of funding sources.
Yeah.
So the first things to fund get cut are the arts. Mm-hmm. So I know that I purposely chose a school for the arts for my kids because I knew music was so important, at least for, you know, through their junior high years and some in high school. But a lot of schools, I remember, and maybe this is just a fluke, and Susan, you can acknowledge this too, because you were in the marching band, but in mm-hmm. high school, I was in a rural community. I mean, we had less than 500 kids in my entire high school, and out of that, 235 were in the marching band.
Whoa.
And then we had other bands,
yeah.
You know, like pep band, jazz. And I've gone to these huge schools, like with my niece and nephew who might be in bigger schools, and there might be 50
yeah.
out on the field. And I don't understand that.
It's dwindled for sure.
Yeah. And I don't know about you, because you were in marching band.
Yeah. So I think, you know, back in the day when I was in marching band, a couple years ago, you know, it was just something that, you know, everybody tried an instrument when starting in the third grade. You played mm-hmm. the little flute thing.
Recorder.
There you go.
Hot cross buns. That's the first thing you learn.
That's right. And so the people that went on are the people that actually liked that experience. So it seemed to be bigger in that day. Nowadays here, at least in the East Valley of Phoenix, there are schools, as they are in Phoenix, that concentrate on musical education. That's mm-hmm. what they're known for. Mm-hmm. And other schools are known for other things like sports or and things like that. So you can get a smaller school with a big, huge band, mm-hmm. different kinds of bands, orchestras, and mm-hmm. Even rock band, jazz band. I mean, if you're a school that specializes in music, you offer everything.
Right.
And if you don't...
But maybe not sports.
Right. Yeah. You may offer sports, but you probably don't win very much.
Their team is called the participants.
Yeah. Yeah. But at least for the schools in my area, mm-hmm. they still do that third grade recorder. Mm-hmm. See who's interested, see who picks that up. Mm-hmm. So that's yeah. really interesting.
I just have one thing to say about the sports. There are studies that compare musicians to highly trained athletes,
uh-huh.
and they look at their brains and they manipulate background noise differently. They both perform better than non-trained athletes and non-musicians. They always do better. However, the musicians can pull the speech out of the noise,
uh-huh.
where the athletes can turn down the noise.
Interesting.
It's fascinating.
That yeah. kind of makes sense, I feel like, because when you're I mean, I'm not an athlete, so here we go. But like, you get that that movie, the Kevin Costner, where he's a pitcher or whatnot, and he can
oh, yeah.
he can turn down the audience. I think uh-huh. it's called it's not The Professional. I forget what it's called.
Yeah.
Sorry, it's one of my friend's favorite movies. Dang it. Anyways, but he can kind of mentally shut out the noise.
Right.
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 And then obviously in a band situation, when you're playing guitar or whatever, you have to be able to pick out different instruments and follow certain things.
Yeah.
So that makes total sense to me.
Yeah.
What is that movie? Dan.
The Natural.
The Natural. Thank you. Thank you, Jill.
Thanks, Jill. So what evidence do we have about neuroplasticity of adult learning? learning to play an instrument that mm-hmm. is beneficial.
Yeah, one of the largest myths and one of the pushbacks you'll get from your adult patients is that I'm too old to learn an instrument. Uh-huh. But they've actually done a lot of studies on the ages 60 to 80 mm-hmm. and put them through a three-month music training program, 3 to 6 months. And they've tested their working memory, their executive function, their ability to hear better in background noise, which improves. And so they put them up against a control group that shows no benefits. But the interesting thing about that, too, is that 6 months after they stop the training program, they still see the same benefits. Wow. So it's not just a quick fix. It stays with you. Mm-hmm. And they've found that even when we were kids and took piano lessons for a couple of years, that the benefits stick with us later in life. There are studies that show after 40 years, you can still see improvements. Wow. And so even with a short amount of training, you get a big amount of benefit. And that's even into their 80s. So
wow.
That's great. And you you specifically chose piano. Was there a reason for that?
Hmm. You know, yes. I was thinking of easiest way I could get my patients to play an instrument. And I thought that if I recommended they get lessons from an instructor, that they wouldn't do it. If they mm-hmm. had to buy an instrument, that they wouldn't do it. So I found an app that trains on the piano, and it actually starts on the tablet or the phone, and then you do shift into a keyboard. But I thought that patients, you know, 85% of Americans have cell phones, and so I thought if we could start it at the app, and the one that would start on the actual phone was piano. So I started there, but then after I had started the piano program, a research article came out in October of 2020 that showed the difference between instruments and found that harmony instruments do show the biggest benefits on the brain. And so guitar and piano are up there. Mm-hmm. Rhythm is kind of a more basic instrument, still shows improvement, consistent practice with it, but the more complex the instrument, the bigger advantage that you have. And so that's why piano came out on the top, and I was kind of happy because that's what I started the program with, just because I wanted it to be really easy for them to go forward.
I would love to read that article at some point and see the differences on it. That's pretty cool. What was it called again?
So I can get it to you. It's from that Bigger Better Brains newsletter, but they looked at 8 different cognitive tests, and the piano playing improved on 5 of the 8 compared to any of the other instruments. So that was the biggest improvement they saw.
There's got to be an instant gratification with piano too, because you hit a key and you can at least recognize the note. Like with violin, if you're not doing the technique right, you're just stringing cats.
Yes, you are. You know?
So that I think it is more approachable. That seems like a little bit more tangible, obvious thing.
So what is the difference between if I just wanted to listen to music, and I listen to music all the time, versus actually playing music? What's the difference in those brain studies?
Yeah, so they started by looking at the brain with just listening to music and saw that, you know, fireworks were going off on the screen. Every part of the brain was activated. But once you create the motor skills involved in playing the instrument, you're going to build up actually more white matter in the brain. You're going to build up that connection stronger. So it's the getting the multitasking and the hands involved for the motor center to improve the structure of the brain. So listening is beneficial, and that's why with tinnitus patients, you're going to see a big improvement, because we're activating every part of the brain, but it's the act of playing it that we see it grow. And that's where we get that that easier learning, the less listening effort. Things are just easier for them.
So what about singing? So being in a choir, or does that have the same effect or as like playing an instrument? Or
at first they do see the benefits of the choir, and it's more the social engagement benefits, like less depression and feeling part of a group, and higher quality of life. But as far as building up the matter in the brain, gray matter, white matter, and that connection of the corpus callosum, it's actually using the hands and playing the instrument.
And so
that was actually out of Nina Krause's lab that they compared, because in the beginning we were saying any kind of music. And, you know, singers use their voice as an instrument.
Absolutely.
However, it's the act of playing that makes it stronger.
There's the vanity center of your brain grows if you're a singer, I've noticed. I think at least.
That stay tuned. Cork will be singing for us.
No, I mostly play.
So in your personal clinic, what kind of success have you seen with your patients that go through this music training?
Mm-hmm. Increased satisfaction. So we look at the handicap scales when they come in to me as far as how their hearing loss is affecting their life. And we ask them the same questions again after the training. We see improvements there. We put them in the booth and do speech and noise testing. So for my hearing aid patients, we use a Quixin. It's part of the audio. My auditory processing patients, we do the W22 in noise. My cochlear implant patients is the AZ Bio. So whatever the protocol for the speech and noise testing, we're going to see improvements after training there too. And then also we do some cognitive screening and watch how that improves. Because based on the research, we should see improvements there. And so we looked at some data, and in the practice, 77% of my patients improved those parameters with just hearing aids alone. And then the 23% that didn't were candidates for the brain training program, and 80% of them improved. And so there were a couple that dropped out. It was just too difficult. They couldn't figure out the app. They couldn't figure out the keyboard. They wanted to go to an actual instructor. And then some that we really, really tried hard for the 3 months and just didn't see the improvements. And so, but a big majority of them improved. And so that was really exciting to see.
So Jill, I heard that Alzheimer's patients who are advanced in their illness that don't respond to speech will sometimes respond to music if it is music that they are very familiar with. It's almost like the Notebook movie, reading a story of their life to bring them back to reality for a short period of time. Have you found that at all to be the case?
Isn't that fantastic? Yeah, there's just this little part of the brain in the memory center that's not affected by Alzheimer's, and it takes the right combination to activate those memories, and it's there in all of us. I learned about that in this book, This Is Your Brain on Music, because if you are not thinking about your second grade teacher's name and someone asks you your second grade teacher's name, you can pull up a bunch of memories that are there, but not necessarily top of mind. And it's kind of like with the Alzheimer's patients, if we have the right recipe to pull back those memories, and a lot of time it's the music, because that gets stored in a part of the brain that's not affected by the disease. And so, that's where also the music therapists come in too. When we've been doing what we can to help their hearing, and we've verified their hearing aids, we've gone through the auditory training program, and there's just not an improvement in the cognitive piece, that's when we can refer to music therapy to pick up the pieces, because they know exactly how to tap into that area, and they can use music to help engage with these people.
Great. Mm. Wonderful. Mrs. Patterson was my second grade teacher.
Mrs. Richards.
Awesome.
Was mine. Miss Richards.
I have no idea.
Activate the center.
That's right. But if I hear a piece of music, it will activate a certain day, a certain time, what I was wearing. Those memories will flood back.
Really?
With a certain piece of music, yes.
Wow.
Definitely.
Mm. That's great. So would your music training program benefit those individuals with moderate to severe hearing losses, or are we looking at mild to moderate hearing losses only?
Absolutely. They're actually a little bit more at risk for other changes in the brain. And so we know from Franklin's research that the severity of the hearing loss can possibly connect to the severity of memory impairment. And so the more moderate to severe are more at risk for changes in cognitive decline. And so as long as we are fitting amplification that is verified, that we know their hearing is back where it should be, and we're stimulating appropriately, everyone can benefit from that music-based training. And so we don't want to leave any of them out.
And so if you put hearing technology on these folks and they do well with that, would you still suggest the music training as well?
Mm-hmm. And so I'm looking at two other pieces of the puzzle, which is their performance in background noise and their cognitive performance. And so together with that, I know if we need to do a little bit more than just the technology, if we want to add that auditory training. And also their satisfaction questionnaire. So if they feel like they're still struggling and they're not as happy as we want them to be, that's part of the physical therapy for the ears or the auditory training.
And have you found with your musical training that people continue with this past the 3 months?
You know, I've only had the two that dropped out, and everyone else has gone beyond. And so I provide 3 months for them. I have a code for the app for 3 months mm-hmm. that they don't have to pay. And then they renew subscription, and I've had people bring in their music books. And so they pick the Beatles or they pick the Rolling Stones, and they brought it into me to show, like, outside of the app that they've actually learned to play pieces. And so it's really awesome.
Oh, that's so cool.
That is.
That's a fun
clinic. I got a video. I got a video at Christmas of one of my patients. She's 7 and her mom is also a patient. And they sent me a video of them playing the first Noel duet. It was so great. It was 5 months after we recommended the training. So that was like the best Christmas gift ever.
Yeah, that's got to be so rewarding to see that.
So what kind of results have you found in your clinic after treating hearing loss through technology and learning how to play the piano? Have your patients improved? And if and in what way have you found the most improvement?
Mm-hmm. Yep, satisfaction with their devices. So I think it's a combination of all together when we see the improvement. So yes, they're performing better in the speech and noise. Their satisfaction's higher, and the cognitive piece has improved as well. But they aren't coming with the same issues that we used to have where would come in and, you know, I'm wearing my hearing aids, but I still can't hear in the coffee shop. I'm still struggling in the restaurant. I'm still not hearing as well in background noise. You just don't have that anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's nice as an audiologist that we don't have those repeat visits where we're trying to do adjustments or figure out, you know, what's wrong here, you know, and looking at the hearing aid. We got to get the focus away from the widget and look more at you know, how we can help them train what they're hearing and look at the cognitive piece as well.
Oh, yeah. That perpetual change of the device. Like it's going mm-hmm. to automatically just make everything better.
Right.
Yes. How would music training benefit everyone?
Yeah. So that bigger, better brain is what we would call it. You know, mm-hmm. the increased connections, the reduction in cognitive load. So the folks that have that training can just hear better easily. And that leaves more cognition reserved for other functions. So when someone doesn't have the music training and they go through difficult listening environments, they've shown an increase in cognitive load. And when you're using so much of it, it makes things harder and you're at risk for decline because you're struggling and working so hard to hear. And so if we can ease the load and free up some of that space for other activities, then we can potentially reduce that risk for cognitive impairment.
Jill, can you just, in your own words, tell our listeners what you mean by cognition and cognitive load?
Yeah, I've been doing some cognitive screening, and I've learned a whole lot about that. And so we're looking at memory, visual, spatial ability, executive function. And so because we know that we need memory, especially working memory, to hear well mm-hmm. and in background noise, mm-hmm. That's why I want to make sure that we have that cognitive piece, that our memory is intact.
Great. And then cognitive load would be just the ease of listening versus difficult listening environments. So mm-hmm. is that how you define it?
Yeah. And I like to refer to the Anu Sharma article where she shows brain reorganization that happens yes. with untreated hearing loss, where everything gets pushed to the frontal lobe. And when you're crowding the memory center of your brain, which is in the frontal lobe, you're working too hard, you start forgetting things. And so that's what I visually picture, shifts that happen in the brain and everything's crowded in that memory center. And that's an increased load.
Yeah. I saw her research and I love the pictures. Visuals are great, you know. She'll say, okay, if we take this out, this is what it happens.
That's a great way of looking at neuroplasticity. So that's a big term, but just to think about your brain is changing and reorganizing as you do different things in different ways. I think that's a great visual way to visualize what's going on.
Right. I think you mentioned this before, but I'm very curious. What about cochlear implant patients? Would your music training benefit those with cochlear implants as well? Or because they're basically being implanted because they have a pretty significant hearing loss in their speech discrimination, the ability to say words back, even at a very loud level, has been degraded. So how can this work on them as well?
Yeah, absolutely. It's more about the verification that the device is stimulating correctly, that we know that their audibility is intact. Mm-hmm. So after implantation, we know that the sound is loud enough. Then we can train using music, kind of as we went back to in the beginning, where people are more excited to accept the training if it's music-based, because speech is really hard to hear, and doing activities that involve repetitive speech is not as fun. And so a lot of the research when I was looking for music training and audiology, putting that together, was all in the cochlear implant world. It was how we train pediatric cochlear implant patients with music first to develop the speech sounds. And so if we can teach children to hear speech better, we can definitely teach adults. And so I think that it's just going back to that rewarding and using music versus burnout of trying to hear verbal and speech training. So, okay. Yeah, absolutely, they would benefit.
So if there's a hearing loss, then how does the music training help those to hear better with their treatment technology, whether it be hearing devices, cochlear implants, FM systems? How does that all work?
Yeah, because music and speech get processed in the same part of the brain. When we learn one, we improve the other. And so with that music training, we can build up our brain's ability to hear the soft differences in the speech. And so it's due to where it's processed in the brain. But going back to evolution, they think that we actually started talking by using music because it's the same language center. And so what is very interesting is that non-musicians use pitch to hear speech, where musicians use melody and tempo. So think of our hearing impaired patients that have high frequency hearing loss. When you're relying on pitch only to be able to hear and that goes away, it's really tough. But with the music training, you can actually pick up on the flow and the tempo and the melody of speech in order to hear and be better at filling in the blanks of what you're missing, the hearing loss.
Whoa. That just blew my mind right there.
Right.
That is really cool. But that makes total sense, right? Because, I mean, with a musician, you're dealing with pitch and rhythm. And so there's two. There's obviously the two categories that you kind of need and are trained on. What the? Sorry, just during that whole time, my jaw was like open completely. Oh my gosh, this is so cool.
Right, so that might explain the patients that we see. Sometimes they have a pretty significant hearing loss, yet I feel like they're doing really well in understanding conversations. And other people that just have a really slight hearing loss, sometimes they have more difficulty than I am expecting. So maybe that should be one of our questions. Have you been musically trained in any way in the past?
Yeah, that's a good point. Do you?
I have it on my intake questionnaire.
Do you?
It's the last question on there, because if they are, they're not a candidate for the program. But also, I put an 88-year-old with a moderate to severe hearing loss through speech and noise testing, and she aced it like she had normal hearing. And I did not have that question at the time. And I said, are you a musician? And she said, a concert pianist my whole life. I'm absolutely wow. You are. Yeah. You just proved my research.
There you go.
Yeah, that is something you guys should be asking for sure.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So a little bit off topic. As you know, Jill, I see patients with auditory processing disorders, and they have normal hearing. So they hear just fine. We call peripheral hearing, meaning they can hear the beeps and the boops and all within normal limits. But they have difficulty in auditory information. And just to remind our listeners out here, we hear in our brain, we don't hear in our ears. So these people especially have problems in noise, similar to our hearing impaired patients. And many times they think they have a hearing loss because they can't hear. Have you attempted your music training on anyone with auditory processing? And what was the outcome?
Well, I added auditory processing testing to my practice during quarantine. Mm-hmm. So I was working on my practice instead of in it when we were in lockdown. And I took a refresher course on auditory processing because I hadn't had it since I was with you. And so I wanted to add that service again. And as I am refreshing myself on the disorders and how they present, I'm thinking they would definitely benefit from the music training because all of the deficits that they have can be improved through music training. So decoding, the ability to quickly and accurately digest speech, that is improved with the training. You know, the phonemes of language are actually the notes of music. And so our ability to read music also translates to our reading in general. But that corpus callosum, a lot of time, is where we see the breakdown in our auditory processing kids. And knowing that music training can build that part of the brain up, I think we can see a lot of improvements in their performance. And also that tolerance of background noise gets better and better. So I'm currently doing some research with the music training and auditory processing specifically. We have a group of patients who are just doing music training. Mm-hmm. We have a group that are adding music training to their existing therapy. And then we're having others do auditory processing therapy only. Mm-hmm. And so by July, I should have a pretty good idea of what we see with those three groups. And so I'm pretty excited. I'll be presenting to the Academy of Audiology in Australia about that research. So we'll see.
That's great. Well, you'll definitely have to have you back in July. I'd love to hear.
Oh yeah.
So with those AP auditory processing, if they have some music training, would you not do the music training? For instance, I actually have a percussionist who is still struggling a bit in the classroom. Should I offer this to her? Because percussion is down on the list, if you will, as far as...
You're right. You're right. That's the rhythm instrument, which is more of a simple... Yeah, so building up to the melody, harmony, it may help. So usually I use existing musicians or music training as a reason not to go forward, but taking into account what type of instrument is a big deal. So I don't think it would ever hurt. So
right.
I think it would depend on the percussion instrument too, whether it be xylophones or very melodic versus, you know, the snare drum.
For example.
So I think there's different levels of percussion too. And technically, I guess piano would be a percussive instrument.
It is.
Well.
It is.
Something hitting something.
Yeah. And when my my kids came home and told me that they're all percussionists because they play piano, I said, no, you're not. I said, yeah, you are. I just learned that in school today.
Yeah. And they're string players too, technically. They're in the string section, right? Because piano is strings.
Yeah. Wow. I don't know, but anyway.
Yeah, that's a good idea, though. Like, if you are a percussionist, I guess kind of widening your range a little bit, doing, like, you know, glockenspiel or xylophone or timpani or something like that.
Right.
Because that's giving you more of the melodic aspect versus just, like you said, snare drum or bass drum.
Yeah.
Right. So if you are set on that, I am percussion.
Branch out.
That's trying to go a little bit into more in depth into the percussion instrument.
If you really want to hit something, just take up xylophone.
Yeah. Really? That's true.
So, Jill, I know that your patients come back and they fill out your surveys and you do some testing, but just speaking with them, how are they noticing changes in their lives after doing the musical training?
Things are easier. I think a common quote is that I'm more with it. Mm-hmm. They don't know exactly what to say, but they just know that they're more engaged, they're more with it. But I think a lot of it is the hearing improvement improves their quality of life. Mm-hmm. The music is fun. They are enjoying playing. They never thought that they could do a hobby like this, and they are happy that they got started. A lot of our patients have pianos sitting there collecting dust. I've learned that as I'm recommending a piano program. They say, oh, I have one, I just don't play it. So it's that extra little push to get out there and mm-hmm. and do it. And so they're really happy that they started. So.
Well, great stuff. Really love it. And gives us a lot to think about, especially for our patients, whether it be cochlear implant patients or those with hearing loss, some added benefit to maybe just the standard treatment. Mm-hmm. Because I think you're right, Jill. I think we all know of those patients that we wish we could do better for. You know, even the patient with severe to profound hearing loss, but is 80 years old and doesn't want to pursue a cochlear implant, you know, there's always something we can do that's better. So I like this training mm-hmm. program that you've developed, and I really appreciate the information that you've shared with us today.
And it's, like you said, Jill, it's fairly new. So to see how this is going to grow and develop in the next 5 years, 10 years or whatever could be huge. And like we've kind of talked about before, it could really open a lot of doors educationally with school systems and mm-hmm. stuff to see the benefits, mm-hmm. You know, the yield on what it actually does for somebody who plays an instrument.
Yeah.
It's huge. And it also makes me not guilty if I force my kids to play an instrument.
Oh, no. Yeah. No.
Like, no, no, your brain's going to get bigger.
That's right.
Play the piano.
We need it to grow.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Well, did you know that brain training apps are a $1 billion industry? People are downloading that Lumosity and uh-huh. BrainHQ and apps to improve their cognitive function. However, there are dozens of research articles that show they improve in playing the games in the app, but their IQ and their memory and executive function, nothing changes. There was actually lawsuits against that. And so my feeling is there's no music-based app to improve the function of the brain. All of these are speech-based and games, video games, that are somewhat helpful. But even the people that did improve in the brain training apps, it didn't last after 3 months.
Yeah, that's what I remember. That it wasn't sustainable.
That, right. Music is the missing piece, I believe. So...
Well, hopefully that'll change with what research you're doing and all of your findings.
Yeah.
So maybe you should do it, and this will just, you know, make you $1 billion right there. $1 billion idea. Should we cut this part out of our podcast so that no one else has it?
Yeah, don't share my secret.
Yeah,
So, Jill, we decided that you have so much great information to share with us that we're going to have part A and part B. So,
gotcha.
Surprise! Yeah. This whole thing for her has been a big surprise.
I know, it's a lot.
So, and we're
so great.
And I'm learning, and Court's learning, and Susan's learning as we're doing this, but.
I'm just soaking all this up. You know what's funny though, Jill, is with the last topic we discussed in episode 3, I no joke was going to call it, I mean, you guys talked about brain and music. I was going to delete your title and call it This Is Your Brain on Music. I really was. And I was like, that book. But I didn't want people to confuse it with the book. Right. So maybe I'll do it. I don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah, well, it doesn't have to be a book. You know, this is your brain on drugs, so that's a popular thing too, right?
I really need to reread that book now.
What, Brain on Drugs?
No. Trust me, that's only a 30-second TV spot. I remember the frying pan.
I do too.
Very well.
And the egg.
Yeah, it's Shannon Doherty too, isn't
it?
90210.
Yeah, it was really? Shannon egg, Doherty? Right?
Yeah, I don't even remember that.
Changed breakfast for me forever.
Okay.
ABHA Listen and Learn is recorded at the Grid Works podcast studio. For more information, go to thegrid.works. We want to thank Jessica, who has helped produce this podcast with her amazing studio and awesome office spaces available at thegrid.works.
Stay with us and join us for the continuation of our discussion with Dr. Jill Davis when she talks about cognitive screening and the use in an audiology clinic.